Good evening, everybody. This is a most wonderful turnout. I'm so pleased. We're all so pleased. Thank you very much for coming. I know that for many of you, as your mind is on Gaza, it was an effort to come here tonight to focus on something different. Many of you, I'm sure, were on the magnificent march yesterday, which was the biggest mark of solidarity with the people of Palestine there's ever been in Britain. I think it marks a real... I think it's a real turning point. And a woman came up to me on the march and she said, I've heard you make so many speeches about how there's going to be a new anti-apartheid movement as strong as that one was to end apartheid in South Africa. There's going to be the same for Palestine. I think it's happened. I think she's absolutely right. Something completely new has happened. And in view of that, there's one thing I have to say tonight that I'm very sorry, particularly sorry, that the other person who was going to be with us on the platform, the former detainee Sami El-Haj, is not able to be with us because he hasn't yet got his visa. Now, Sami is somebody who has tried to go to Gaza. He was on one of the boats, the one called, appropriately, the Dignity, that was actually rammed by the Israeli Navy. And therefore, for us to have had him here on this particular night was going to be extremely important and poignant. So before we start the meeting proper, I'm going to ask Mozem to read a poem by Sami, and that's our imagining of having him here. So we'll just start with that.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, most compassionate, most merciful. This was written by Sami El-Haj, the former Al Jazeera cameraman and Guantanamo detainee, whilst he was detained in Guantanamo. It's called Humiliated in the Shackles. When I heard pigeons cooing in the trees, hot tears covered my face. When the lark chirped, my thoughts composed a message for my son. Muhammad, I am afflicted. In my despair, I have no one but Allah for comfort. The oppressors are playing with me as they move freely about the world. They ask me to spy on my countrymen, claiming that it would be a good deed. They offer me money and land and freedom to go where I please. Their temptation seize my attention like lightning in the sky. But their gift is an evil snake, carrying hypocrisy in its mouth like venom. They have monuments to liberty and the freedom of opinion, which is all well and good. But I explain to them that architecture is not justice. America, you ride on the back of orphans and terrorize them daily. Bush, beware. The world recognizes an arrogant liar. To Allah, I direct my grievance and my tears. I am homesick and oppressed. Muhammad, do not forget me. Support the cause of your father, a God-fearing man. I was humiliated in the shackles. How can I now compose verses? How can I now write? After the shackles and the nights and the suffering and the tears, how can I write poetry? My soul is rolling like a sea stirred by anguish, violent with passion. I am a captive, but the crimes are my captors. I am overwhelmed with apprehension. Lord, unite me with my son Muhammad. Lord, grant success to the righteous.
Thank you very much, Mozem. Now, I'll just introduce myself. My name is Victoria Britton, and I'm extremely privileged and happy to have been invited to chair this meeting for cage prisoners. As you all know, it's the 7th anniversary of the opening of the Guantanamo Bay prison camp. And I think, for those of us who started thinking about it 7 years ago, it was absolutely unthinkable that something so inhuman and so outrageous could be allowed to continue. as you know, there are still more than 200 people there. And among the things that we're going to discuss this evening is what's going to happen to those 200 people. What is the possibility of a real change with the new administration in America and a new setup in the Justice Department, which will replace the completely debased justice that took place under the Bush administration. But before I introduce the speakers, I just want to particularly welcome four other people who are here tonight, who are former detainees in Guantanamo who've come home to their families. They're in the audience, and some of them you may know by face and some of them not. But it's Jamil Albana, Omar Degayas, Tarek Degul, and Martin Mubanga. So, to move to our platform, I don't think I need to introduce Moazzam. You know exactly who he is and what a completely heroic role he has played in making this society aware of what has gone on in Guantanamo. And for all that he's done within this society, and the many times you may have heard him or seen him on radio, on TV, or in the flesh, he's doing that by TV in every other country. And I think it is a role that he'll always be remembered for. Now, the other guests will be less familiar to you. On the right of Moazzam is Jarallah Almari, who is himself a former detainee from Guantanamo, and he's here in particular in a very, very important campaign for his brother, Ali Almari, who is the only person held in the United States as an enemy combatant, and we're going to talk about that in more detail as we go along. And on my left, there's somebody that I want you to recognize very especially. His name is Christopher Arendt, and he is a former guard at Guantanamo. And he's come here at the invitation of Cage Prisoners, and with Moazzam and Sami, and partly with Jarallah, he'll be making a tour of different cities in Britain, talking about Guantanamo from his experiences. And I think the bravery that it has required for him to want to come and do that with us is something very special. So I would like you to welcome him.
Hello. It's very nice to meet all of you. My name is Christopher, and in my country, I'm what we call trailer park trash. I don't know what you guys call it here in England. I believe you call them hoodlums. And when I was 17, I made the one decision that would not only inform, but make all of the rest of the decisions for the next 6 years of my life that meant anything. I joined the Army National Guard, which I'm pretty comfortable saying was a gigantic mistake. I joined the field artillery upon the promise that it was virtually impossible that I would ever be deployed in the Global War on Terror because I was not super enthusiastic about the idea of participating in this war. I wasn't necessarily enthusiastic about participating in any war. I wasn't full of ideas that any of that would be any fun. I most envisioned myself sandbagging the Mississippi, or I don't know, maybe saving cats out of trees or something like that. So something much more innocuous than what eventually happened. But then came the day in October when my totally insane chief, my section chief named Sergeant Caswell, called me on the phone in a classically immoderated way, barked out, raging bull, and that was it, hung up the phone. So he had no idea how to communicate with other human beings. And raging bull had already been established as our call signal for that we were going to be deployed. So I started drafting up plans to leave the country or to, maybe change my gender and get a new name or something like that to get out of it. But none of that really panned out, and it all kind of, time was running out, and I couldn't find a place that was going to change my gender, get me plastic surgery quickly enough, and certainly didn't have the money for the operation. So I went into drill the next month that we had it, because National Guard is one weekend a month or 2 weeks a year while George Bush is in office, and definitely forever whenever they want you to be there for all time. So I went into drill, and we all gossiped about where we were going, and we were pretty sure it was going to be Iraq, which is, I'm sure all of you can imagine where people that fire cannons are most necessary. Well, not necessarily at all, really, but we imagined that at least we'd be able to keep our jobs, our military occupational specialties. It came as a shock, I guess, when Captain Russell, our commander, walked in front of our platoon, and we were sitting on the bleachers, and he said, "Get yourself ready, Charlie, we're going to Guantanamo Bay." And I'd heard about Guantanamo Bay before, and I was pretty positive that was a rather touchy political subject. Guantanamo Bay, as far as I could pick out from the news, was where they kept all of the hardened terrorists and all of the people that were directly responsible for 9/11. And, well, at least that's what we were getting on our end of the news. And I looked around me at a bunch of old, toothless, white hillbillies, and I was thinking, why would they pick us? Why would they send us to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba? That seems ridiculous. I can't for the life of me imagine why they would pick probably the most culturally insensitive people that I've ever met in my whole life that had decided that I was A, a homosexual, and B, that was something that made me not worth anything just because I read books and could speak in sentences that contain more than five words, and sometimes I didn't even swear. It seemed like a peculiar decision by the Pentagon to send us down there, and I pretty much wrote it off as a fluke. And nonetheless, at this point in time, my concerns were mostly just about myself. I didn't want to leave my family, and I didn't want to leave my friends. The deployment at the time was sold to us as an indefinite deployment of upwards of 2 years, and I don't know how many people have had to leave their families or their friends for 2 years, or any time really at all, to hang out with people that you don't want to hang out with and do things you don't want to do. But it's not something I look forward to at all. So I sulked, and I went home, and I didn't tell anybody, I didn't tell any of my friends, and I just kind of tried to pass it off and act like everything was okay, and I wasn't going to go anywhere, and I just let November sneak up on me, because November was when we were leaving. And eventually November snuck up on me, and we left, and I tried my hardest to get out of the deployment and to tell them that I was crazy, and not necessarily crazy, but military crazy, that I really didn't think that I could do what they were going to ask of me. They wanted me to go down to a place where I was going to have to be a big, be a big, mean man and walk up and down cells and push people around and tell them what to do and keep them down. And I used to like smiling quite a bit. I like jokes, and I don't really like pushing people, and I'm not a very violent person. I never really liked any of that. I never met a Muslim person before in my whole life because I was fairly trash. And in Michigan, it's not exactly right with Islamic culture. I didn't know anything about Islamic culture. I couldn't even have told you what a Quran was before I went to Guantanamo. And I tried to tell him, I can't do this. You got the wrong guy. I screwed up. I signed the paper. I'm sorry. Let me off the hook. I'm not who you want down there. I'm not your guy. And it's going to make me depressed. I told them. They asked me, well, would you ever hurt yourself or would you ever kill anybody? And I said, almost certainly. I would definitely, like at the time, I was definitely suicidal. I didn't see myself coming home from that deployment. It wasn't a dangerous deployment. We weren't gonna fight anybody. I would never even hold a weapon while I was down there except to qualify on the range. But I didn't think I was gonna make it back home. I was almost certain something was gonna change over the course of that, it was going to make life not worth living, and we were only in the mobilization stage, and I was so depressed I could barely even get myself out of bed in the morning, and I hated the people I was with, so it was also, if it wasn't suicide, I was going to end up killing somebody from my unit, for sure, but that didn't pan out. They told me I had commitments, and that I'd signed papers, and the military takes signing papers very seriously. At least in the United States military, because they take promises very seriously. But as you can see, our new president-elect Obama doesn't take promises seriously at all.
We'll come to Obama. Chris, let's go to when you first met detainees and how was your interaction with them?
Well,
how did you find them? You said you'd never met a Muslim person before.
No, one of the first Muslim people I ever met in my life is sitting in this audience right now. The very first day I worked on the blocks, I worked on Oscar Block, which is an isolation block. It's where the men that are in Guantanamo Bay are kept inside of solid steel walls that are approximately—they're the same size as the normal cells. They're about 5 by 8 feet, and the detainees in there can barely hear one another. Guantanamo is already extremely hot, but when you put somebody in a solid metal box, they get pretty agitated. And as I later found out, this gentleman had spent a good deal of time in these metal boxes, and it was my first day on the blocks, and I was pretty nervous because I didn't know what to say. I wanted to apologize, but I couldn't. I didn't even know if anybody spoke English, and what was I gonna, how could I possibly apologize for what was going on? And I just kept walking up and down. He was screaming at me. He wanted something, but I just kept ignoring him and walking by and ignoring him and ignoring him. And finally, I realized that he was speaking English, and all he wanted was toilet paper. So I ignored him a little bit more, and then I finally grabbed a roll of toilet paper, and I gave him the standard amount of toilet paper, which is 8 sheets of toilet paper. And he told me that it's not 8 sheets; it's three rolls around a hand. And I was like, "No, man, it's 8 sheets." And he said, "3 rolls around a hand." And so I rolled it around my hand 3 times, and then gave him the toilet paper. And when I put my hand in the cell to give him the toilet paper, he grabbed my hand and he did the, like, kind of an alligator roll with my hand. And then I pulled my hand out, and we just kind of stared at each other for a while. And then we parted ways, and I thought about that the whole time I was there. It was the first time that I'd ever treated anybody like that in my whole life, and these things stay with me. So I thought about that for the rest of my time in Guantanamo, and after I'd gone home, and thought about how angry that guy must have been. And we had dinner together.
How did you feel when you met him at dinner last night?
Yeah, when we had dinner last night, I felt like he was a normal human being. I felt like I was sitting at a table with somebody that understood something that I don't think anybody else is ever going to understand. I'm not going to be able to explain Guantanamo Bay to you, Mozam can speak as well as anybody I've ever met in the world. I've never met anybody that has explained Guantanamo better than anybody, and I don't think that he's ever going to be able to explain it to you in a way that is going to make anybody understand fully what it's like there. I don't think anybody's going to
understand. Chris, I'll just ask you a question. 2 days ago, we had dinner with, or you had dinner with some of the world's most dangerous men. That included myself and probably about 12 other Guantanamo detainees, and another man who's in this city but not in this audience, I think, who was held in Bagram for 6 years. What did you think?
Well, I thought the company was delightful. And
you had no choice, mate.
Honestly, it was about the happiest I've ever seen a table of 15 people in my whole life. I had a wonderful time. It was I felt like I was sitting at a table with more or less family. I'm not myself a Muslim. I don't practice any religion whatsoever, but that didn't really hold anything back. I mean, we're united in this cause together, and we've all seen the thing which is probably going to haunt all of us for the rest of our lives, which is going to remain a part of our psyches, which, like I was saying before, is virtually inexplicable. So we share something that a majority of the world, a vast majority of the world, is never going to see. So
Chris,
in that way, we're...
You walked into a mosque with me yesterday, and when I was praying, you heard something that the last time you heard was in Guantanamo. How would you describe that thing that you heard? What does it sound like to you?
It wasn't the sound of it. It's a beautiful song. It being a call to prayer, which is formerly when I was working on the blocks in Guantanamo, which was my favorite part of the day. It was especially on night shifts when you'd be walking up and down, and you've walked this block 500 times. I used to walk up and down, and I'd take a chance at the end of the cell block when I was far enough away from everybody else while they were playing solitaire, smoking cigarettes and talking about motorcycles or whatever, to read a book I had. And the detainees were all sleeping in their cells, and it was generally the only time the only peaceful time that we had there together. And then the first call to prayer would come up, and it's probably the most phenomenally, totally, bizarrely beautiful thing you're ever going to see 48 men get off of metal slabs that they sleep on a cliff that's on the ocean that overlooks the ocean as the sun is rising up, and to see these men all get down in unison and then sing this beautiful song, which to me I didn't understand it religiously. To me, it wasn't, as I said, I'm not a Muslim. The call to prayer to me doesn't, I understand its spiritualness, but it's not my song. But it's aesthetically, it's a beautiful song. And to be there in Guantanamo, just this really weird place, and to hear this, song, and see all these men just inside the cages. It's the craziest. You can't even explain it. It's the craziest aesthetic you're ever going to come across. I've never been so confused in my entire life as to just be, to be able to witness that. I feel like I got to see like a bird in a rainforest that no one's ever seen before or something, Like, I feel like I got to see something that no one's ever going to see. And also to come from a place where that kind of faith just doesn't exist. Where I come from, we have faith in nothing. We distrust everything. And to see people that all they had was a toothbrush that was an inch long, and a prayer mat, which was just a PT mat. It's what I had in basic training to do sit-ups on, and a sheet, not even a proper blanket or anything, just a white sheet, and just a few things, a styrofoam cup, but to see to see these people still every day wake up and to engage in this act of faith was really beautiful.
There's a thing that happens every day at sunset, every single day. As Muslims, we know it's called the Adhan, the call to prayer, which you spoke about. But precisely also at that time, something happens in the U.S. military.
It's the national anthem.
So you have a battle for the airwaves between the Adhan and the national anthem.
Well, at first, if we didn't used to play the call, we didn't used to play the call to prayer. We left that to the detainees until, I believe it was General Miller, who is a first-rate jerk, who wanted...
He still is.
Absolutely. I'm positive that remains solid. Who did everything he could to make sure that Guantanamo was the least pleasant place anybody could ever spend any time. Did soldiers and detainees alike. He was roundly hated by all people in Guantanamo Bay. Everything. So General Miller is the enemy of all human beings. He instituted playing the call to prayer, a CD version, which I don't know, they probably cheaply bought from somebody, some crappy version that we play on these giant speakers, and we it was so ridiculous to see the detainees praying and us running to try to get undercover so we didn't have to salute our own flag.
Just to explain, Chris, the American soldiers, what are you required to do when the national anthem plays?
You've got to stop in your tracks and salute the flag, or salute the direction that the flag is in.
Okay, and that is a great contrast, because we as Muslims, we have to also stop in our tracks, and we have to salute the object of our devotion, which is our God.
Except that you guys, the detainees seem to like doing that.
Let me just ask you one more question, and then later on in the evening, you'll all have a chance to ask any questions you want of any of the people on the panel. I just want to ask you, were there many other guards who felt like you?
There very well could be, but we live inside of our heads. I've only now met the other soldiers from the war on terror and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have an organization called Iraq Veterans Against the War, which I'm a part of. And we're only now coming out after getting out of the military, because we just don't talk about these things in the military. You're certainly not the coolest kid on the block if you start talking about how you think things are wrong, or how the United States military is all messed up, or how the global war on terror is, basically a racist, awful thing, and that we're being used for corporate pillaging. We didn't talk like that. And I was, around a bunch of very intimidating men who I was already terrified of. So I more or less kept my mouth shut, so I didn't really find out whether or not anybody else believed it, but not a whole lot of other people believed like they thought felt like it was wrong, or acted like they felt like it was wrong. But as far as I could tell by most of the other soldiers' actions, they thought it was to some degree even fun. They seemed to enjoy doing what they did, but.
Right. Well, thank you very much indeed, Chris. That was a very honest and touching description of a very special and strange experience. And as I said, you'll be able to ask more questions afterwards. I want to move on now to talk about the very strange and terrible case of Jarallah's brother, Ali. And I'm going to ask Mirzem to just describe the case. As I said, this is the only person held as an enemy combatant in the United States. The previous person who you may have read more about is Jose Padilla. And this case is particularly important now when we're in this situation of the 230 people whose future none of us know, because it hasn't been decided, But it's quite possible that some of those people will be moved to the United States, and they may find themselves facing the same kind of designation as an enemy combatant in the same kind of limbo as Ali al-Mari. So I'll hand over to Mirzem just to begin to talk about this case. Oh, okay. They're doing it differently. Jarana will speak and Mirzem will translate.
شكرا جميع الحضور يعني سامحوني اني لا اتكلم اللغه الانجليزيه جيده علما ان انجليزيتي هي باللهجه الامريكيه او بالامريكان اكسنت لاني جلست 7 سنوات في غوانتانامو فاخذت اللهجه.
He says thank you everybody and that he asks your pardon for not speaking in English. He says his English is not that good, and even if it was, it's with an American accent.
صراحة يسعدني عندما أرى هذا الجمع الكبير من الحضور ويتكلمون عن ناس محرومين عن حقوقهم الإنسانية.
It makes me greatly happy and joyful to see that there are so many people who are interested in the cases of people detained who have no rights afforded to them.
طبعاً هم عرفوكم عن اسمي جار الله المري من الدوحة قطر وخرجت من السجن تقريباً من 6 أشهر.
You know about me, my name is Jarullah al-Marri and I was released from Guantanamo in July of 2008.
سبب حضوري هنا عندما أخبروني الكيج بريزنر يوجد حملة فأردت الاشتراك فيها وذكر عن بعض مواضيع أخي علي.
I was informed by cage prisoners about this event taking place, and I wanted to come here specifically for the purpose of talking about not my own case, but about my brother Ali, who is in the United States.
عندما خرجت من جزيرة غوانتانامو، الجزيرة التي لن أنساها طول حياتي، خرجت وكنت حاملا هم كيف نخرج باقي المعتقلين من غوانتانامو.
When I was released from Guantanamo Bay, a place that I will never forget in my entire life, I first of all thought after my release about the people still detained there and what can I do to help them.
حقيقة عندما خرجت سمعت ورأيت يعني كل الناس أو بكل العالم كلهم يتكلمون عن الجرائم التي تحصل.
And when I was returned, when I was released, I realized that the whole world is in fact talking about all of the crimes that are taking place in Guantanamo. This was in the media and in the newspapers and so forth. And yet I found and discovered that nobody wants to talk about the case of my brother Ali, who is detained in the United States of America, not in Guantanamo.
الولايات المتحدة الأمريكية يزعمون عندهم ديمقراطية في القانون، فأخي علي يعيش داخل الأراضي الأمريكية بدون أي حقوق إنسانية.
The United States of America purports to be a nation that offers justice and democracy, and yet my brother has been detained there since 7 years without any charge or without any trial. And this is from my own addition, that he is the only enemy combatant, the only person designated enemy combatant in the United States of America as it stands.
الجندي الأمريكي الذي كان حارسا علينا في غوانتانامو كان يقول ويتحدث معكم التعذيب الذي حصل للمعتقلين في غوانتانامو.
The American soldier Chris, who just spoke about some of the tortures that took place, were about Guantanamo.
قبل ترشيح أو قبل اختيار الرئيس الجديد أوباما كان في وعود كثيرة بإغلاق جزيرة غوانتانامو أو بإغلاق معتقل غوانتانامو.
There were many promises by President-elect Barack Obama that he would indeed close Guantanamo as soon as he came into office.
سؤالي إلى الرئيس المرشح أوباما ماذا سوف يفعل بمعتقلين غوانتانامو عندما يغلق جزيرة غوانتانامو؟ هل هو سوف ينقلهم إلى مكان المكان معتقل الذي فيه أخي؟
My question then to Obama would be this: What do you intend to do with the prisoners in Guantanamo who you will not release and return to their homes? Will you send them to the United States of America and deal with them in the manner that you have dealt with my brother? In reality, I do not believe these promises that have been given by Obama at all.
يوجد في معتقل غوانتانامو في الكثير من الناس مغربين عن الطعام.
I've still heard from the latest information, and of course Ali himself, Jarallah, is one of the latest prisoners to be released from there, is that people are still being tortured. They're mentally and psychologically being tortured, and that many people are still, as a result of this, on hunger strike.
وشكرا لجميع الحضور.
Thank you very much for everybody.
Thank you very much, Jarallah. Again, when after Mirzam spoken, you'll be able to ask more questions, either about that case or about Jarallah's own experiences in Guantanamo. I mean, he's raised the question that I think is in all our minds now, after this 7 years, what is going to happen to those 230 or so people that are there now? And I know that we have in the audience several of the lawyers who are working on the complexities of trying to find places for some of these people to go and live when they can't go back to their own country because of the fear of torture. So I hope that in the course of the evening, some of them will make some contributions and tell us about the very important work that they're doing. But I'd just like now to ask Mirzam to speak a little bit about what are the lessons of this horrible 7 years, and where are we now, and what has it done to our own society that our leadership has been complicit with the appalling injustice that the Americans have perpetrated in Guantanamo, in Bagram, and in all the secret prisons that the men that we've mentioned earlier here today know so much more about than any of us will ever know. So, Mirzam.
7 years, brothers and sisters and friends, 7 years is the date today since Guantanamo was opened and shown to the people around the world with the pictures of the men kneeling in orange suits, wearing blackened out goggles, earmuffs, and face masks, made to look like the extraterrestrial beings we were supposed to be. The aliens, that's the terminology used to describe us, the enemy aliens, the enemy combatants. That's who we were, that's who we still are. We are still regarded as enemy combatants. As a result of that designation, there are several of us, some of us in this room, who are not allowed to travel. We are not allowed to leave this country because of that designation of enemy combatant. As supposedly free citizens of this country, we are still regarded as threats to the security of the world. And how much has this done for the world's security? We can see that people in Guantanamo Bay will always be related to the color orange. And although I say to you, brothers and sisters and friends, that the future is not orange, it is inshallah bright. And that is one of the things that I try to keep fixed to. The Quran says clearly, فَإِنَّ مَعَ الْعُسْرِ يُسْرًا إِنَّ مَعَ الْعُسْرِ يُسْرًا. That after difficulty comes ease. Indeed, after difficulty comes ease. That has been the case for many of us who have been returned and have been able to carry out the work that we want to do. But for many people, that ease has yet to come, yet to manifest itself. And there are particular individuals who I think of and cannot stop thinking of when I talk about this ease not having come yet. One of them is my close friend, Shakir Ahmed. And even Chris had heard of Shakir Ahmed as the professor. He is one of the most intelligent men, despite not having a college degree or any other degree. Despite not having studied a great deal, he's one of the most intelligent people that I knew, but more importantly, how they regarded him in Guantanamo and gave him this title, the professor, simply because he was able to point out the inconsistencies, the discrepancies of the US military, the hypocrisies that existed with an American accent. And Shakir Ahmed, the last I heard of him through one of the lawyers who's here, who'd spoken to people who knew something of him, was held in a glass cell, a glass cage, so that he's not able to throw some of the things that Chris spoke of earlier on because of his protesting and because of his being tied up and held in this place for such a long time. But more disturbingly, Shakir has children. He has a wife, and they're in this city. He has a child who is 7 years old, one of his children, his youngest child, that he has never seen in his life. This child doesn't know what it's like to have a father. No idea. When the child goes to school and people ask, where's your dad? And the child has to say, my dad's in prison. How do you explain that to other children? I'm telling you, you can't explain it to adults. You cannot say to an adult that Guantanamo Bay is such a terrible place. How can a child explain it to another child? It's impossible. So that when other children come and have their fathers come to sports day or to parents' evening or to have them collected from school, poor little Faris has to have a neighbor, a relative, somebody else. Doesn't know what a father is. And this is just the case of Shakir Ahmed. There are many others. There are 250 people held in Guantanamo still who are fathers and who are sons and who are husbands and cousins and people. What has become of them? Most people don't know. Remember, the majority of people in Guantanamo Bay speak this language, speak the language of Jarallah. They don't speak English. They don't want to speak English in many cases. And it's their voices that often don't get heard. It's their voices that people think, well, who cares? It's just an Arab, it's just a Somali, it's just a Turk, it's just an Afghan. Who cares? But it's their voices that are the most important, that after 7 years, still we're finding that there is no end to this black or this endless tunnel. And while we're talking about Barack Obama and everybody being euphoric at the idea of this black president, and first in the history of the United States of America, which is great for America, but it does very little to address the issues that we've come here to listen to about today. What is going to happen to Guantanamo? What is going to happen to the people that are held in Guantanamo? And before you ever get to Guantanamo, brothers and sisters and friends, you have to go through a process. You have to be cleansed as far as the US military is concerned. And that cleansing process takes you through dark prisons like Bagram, where you see people beaten to death. And as I said to you earlier on today, I thought I'd had it bad in Bagram. I thought my 11 months in Bagram were hard and difficult. And then I met a man who was held there for 4 years in this city. He's here now. And 2 years in one of the dark prisons. And he said to me after the dark prison, he was looking forward to going to Bagram. And I say to you that after Bagram, I was looking forward to going to Guantanamo. That's the situation. And if we want to look at the wider war on terror, that Guantanamo may be closed, but just like in the statement of Malcolm X, you don't take a knife and stick it in a man's back 9 inches deep and pull it back 3 inches and say, haven't we made progress? Because that's what's happening in Guantanamo. Guantanamo was illegal to begin with, but the process that they had and continue to maintain about extraordinary rendition and enforced disappearances have been adopted by other countries around the world, which includes Pakistan. Pakistan was never the best of places for human rights. But the idea of disappearances never happened up until after the war on terror. And then you saw a whole spate of disappearances and people protesting in the streets, including lawyers, calling for those disappeared persons to be brought to a court. So the war on terror has brought in a new dimension, a new dynamic completely that didn't exist as a result of this. And at its head is Guantanamo. But beneath it lies a whole series of processes that include secret detention and extraordinary rendition. And nobody's addressed that, and nobody's claiming to address that. In fact, if you look at the statements made by President-elect Obama, he said that he will close Guantanamo, remove the troops from Iraq, and push them into Afghanistan. This is where it all began. Afghanistan was all began with where it was first started. It was in the prisons of Bagram that people were tortured into giving confessions that led to the invasion of Iraq. So it's come back home, as in the words of some people, the chickens will come home to roost. And then what we will see, by extension and necessity, if they will increase the numbers of troops in Afghanistan, the war will continue. And if the war will continue, more people will die and more houses will get raided. And in those raids, there will be more people captured and taken and put into the cells of Bagram. Nobody has addressed that and spoken about that at all. Because that is the part of the story people still don't want you to hear about. So the future may look bleak, but I still remain an optimist, because what I see in this room are people from all backgrounds and all walks of life coming along to listen to issues that a few years ago people were too terrified to even discuss. So that is an extremely important step that we've made forward. And particularly because of Chris coming over here. Chris was extremely young when he joined the military. And when he first emailed me, he said something that I wish you could have understood and seen. Mazam, do you understand? I was just a kid at the time. I remember when I was growing up in the 80s, there was a song called 19. The average age of the American soldier in Vietnam was 19. These men were sent off by their governments to go and fight and kill for a war they couldn't even understand or pronounce properly. They're back again doing it. So it takes some courage and it takes some foresight for some of these men. And there have been several others. There are several other former guards and in some cases interrogators who have phoned and spoken to me and cried down the phone. Cried. I'm sorry, Mozan, for what I did. I'm sorry for my role in this. I bought the hype. They told me you were murderers and terrorists and opposed to everything that we stand for and you want to kill us all. Sorry. That's all I can say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mozan. Well, now we've got time for plenty of questions and contributions. But I'm just going to answer the first question before you've asked it. Somebody will immediately ask, what can I do? People always do from these meetings. And given that it's such a wonderfully big meeting and such a great feeling of motivation, and I think because we're all so revved up about the horrible, horrible thing that's going on in Gaza, I think that people are ready to take action. And I want to ask everybody here to write to the Home Secretary and to the American ambassador here on the case of Shaka Ahmed and the two other British residents who should be brought back immediately to this country. There has already been a commitment. They've said we'll have them back, but they haven't done anything about it. And as we know from the former residents, Jamil and Omar and Bisha, they said, oh, we'll bring them back. But it actually took their lawyers bringing yet more court cases to finally force the Home Office to do it. And at that time, they felt they could get away with it because there was not this kind of mobilisation. But if everybody in this room wrote those letters this week, I think we would begin to see a result from Jackie Smith. So I beg you please to do that. And the second thing I want to say, in case anybody leaves before we finish, is it's very, very important to support both cage prisoners and HUGs, because the work that they do in not just in organising meetings like this, but the work that they do behind the scenes in supporting the families who are going through the most difficult circumstances within this country is so important, and no one else is doing it. So I ask you to join Cage Prisoners if you haven't already, to make donations either with standing orders or as you go out. Don't think it happens by magic. It's incredibly hard work, and they do it on a shoestring. So every penny that you give will be very, very well used. So thank you very much. I don't know if we've got any mics down there, but if you'd like to... Oh, there is a mic there. Thanks. Great. Could I just see a few shows of hands as to people who want to ask questions or make statements? I can see up in the gallery. You might have to come down to make yours. I don't think we can get it up there, so if you make your way. Who else? Can I see some hands? Okay. Well, let's start with these two over here. And if you could introduce yourself, just to that would be great. Omar, can you hold the mic close so we can hear you well?
Yes, and the question, I have two questions here to Chris and to Jonathan Miller. First one is to Chris, is that tell us about the things that, the bad things that probably some other guys, probably yourself even, the worst things that you have done in Guantanamo, and other guys also in Guantanamo, what did they, the bad things that they did to the detainees, because it would be a different
Well, you're not going to put me in any more awkward position than my government already has, so don't worry about it, my friend. I'm not necessarily going to say I'm not ashamed, but I've done the things I've done, and I mean, I have to own up to those things. We didn't have any oversight in Guantanamo Bay on the blocks. We had usually a block sergeant who was an E5 or an E6. You know that. We didn't have. You never saw any officers there. You never saw any. You barely ever saw a platoon sergeant who's too busy, sleeping in the guard shack in the middle of the causeway or something. It ranged from the mundane to the extravagant shows of force. On the day-by-day basis, some extremely derogatory terms were used. I'll spare you them because I don't even want to say them. I've said them for the media a couple of times now, and they make me feel sick. And I can't say them anymore. But and you also know that you know the language that we use down there. That was all day, every day. The instantaneous reactionary force, the forced cell extractions, which I never participated in myself except for videotaping, those oftentimes, even though those are essentially a violent thing in and of themselves, even within the constraints of the standard operating procedure, are violent things. We're often exponentially more violent than they needed to be, even though they are exponentially more violent than they need to be anyway, because after spraying the detainee with the OC spray, it's not necessary to send 5 grown men in with a riot shield. You could probably send a child in to zip tie a detainee after spraying them with OC sprays. I witnessed a lot of excessive uses of force. I didn't walk out of this with clean hands either. As I said earlier, I was an ignorant, selfish American for the most part. I ignored a lot of everything. I watched a lot of things happen that I was probably going to be the only person that could have spoken up and reported. I never reported anything. I never filled out a paper. I never, I watched a detainee get kicked in the face by a platoon sergeant. Didn't put that in, so I'm, guilty of that. I dragged a detainee across the ground with the help of another soldier, as ordered. What is that sound? So I guess we're just going to persevere. Whatever that is. Wow. I think it's over now. I dragged this is ridiculous. I dragged the detainee across the ground, across the rocks, and I once again stood by and even participated in bashing that detainee's head against a metal pole. Never reported that. Because I was ashamed, afraid to ask people to do too much in one of my positions, I let detainees sit in interrogation cells for too long. Sometimes maybe an extra half an hour, shackled to the floor. These were all done out of ignorance and laziness and selfishness.
You think it's that? Is there any techno person who might be able to solve this beep, beep, beep?
Excuse me, it has happened in Brighton before when someone's been playing on a mobile phone. It interferes with the PA.
If there's a guilty person playing on their mobile phone, could you please stop? Is it okay now? Thank you. Yeah, let's take that question. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start speaking English. Don't be surprised.
But actually, I wasn't relaxed in English, first of all, but now I'm relaxed. So thank you for my brother, Omar, to that question. Before I answer Omar's questions, I'm going to go back to Muazzam, what he said to the interrogators and the guards, they crying in the phone, and the mistake they did. I told, it's not enough to cry. It's enough to stand close to Chris, to do what Chris doing, to release the other people in the other cages. And answer for my brother questions is, Ali, they treat Ali, my brother, and he say, land is worse than Guantanamo. Can you imagine somebody living in a little cell, 14 months, he didn't talk to anybody without linen, or I mean without clothes, they call linen. Without clothes and no blankets from 5 to 10, and they just turn on the water 3 times for a break. And can you imagine somebody living in a 14 month in a little cell without medical treatment? So my brother Ali, they torture him more than the others. I mean, Guantanamo. So he's by himself. Complete isolation. No calls, no letters, no nothing. Nobody talked to him, even the doctor. So this is an United States land. And about the another question from my brother Omar is, how is the treatment in Guantanamo? I think you heard all of you about the Guantanamo treatment. It's really, I cannot explain it, but it's really worse. And I remember the detainees now, the hunger striking, what they did for them. They just have so pressure right now, because I heard that 30 Yemenis now, the hunger striking. And thanks.
There's a question over here.
Islam Channel question.
Assalamu alaikum. My name is Saeed Jamal. The question is for Rora Jalal. When you release one man's animal pain, how is it received in the was allowed back with any precondition before you were allowed to enter? And what is the government of Qatar doing to help your brother, considering it has such good relations with America and the Arab League in general?
Alaykum as-salam. Thank you very much. How the trip is first from Guantanamo to my country, when they released me, I was a chuckled up. My hands cuffed and it's to my stomach. The same way I came to Guantanamo, the same way I get out. Before the Qatar government received me from the American government, 5 minutes, they took the chuckles out. They just put a little plastic, I don't know what they call it. And when they received me, the Qatar government, they just cut it. And I became a normal guy, a normal man. I just a minute ago, I was they called me a terrorist. Now I'm a normal man. About the Qatar, how they received me, Qatar, they just said, I stay with my Qatar government just 1 day and a half only for routine government. And they released me at all. And I don't want to release me, because I cannot accept the people, because I wasn't 7 years in isolation, and they just let me, they won't see the people. And slowly I couldn't make it. Thanks.
Thank you. Who was the person who came down from upstairs? Could you give him the mic? It's just there by the door. Thank you.
Thank you. Is this possible to ask my questions in Arabic?
Can you go closer to the mic?
Yes, no, inshallah, no.
Okay.
Is عندي سؤالين، سؤال الأخ جار الله وسؤال السيد قيس كلامي. هل شعرتم أخي الكريم أن هذه المعاملة هي حرب على الإسلام بصفة عامة، أم أنها حرب على طائفة أبت الظلم والذل والإهانة ولانصياع لهذا النظام المتحرش؟ هذا السؤال الأول.
ممكن أترجمها أولا؟ The question is to both, I think, Jarullah and to Chris. He said, do you see this as a war against Islam and Muslims, or is it just a war against a small group of people who have been humiliated and attacked and so forth? What do you see this as? Namathani.
Jarullah,
do you want to translate in Arabic or in English?
Yajib al Islam. السؤال. نعم.
Actually, your question is very important. The answer is clear. Who is the detainee in Guantanamo? It's just only Muslim people. There is no other Muslim people. Just only Muslim people in Guantanamo. I've been in Guantanamo 6 years and 8 months. I find all of them Muslims. No other religion. Thank you.
Yeah, it's Islamophobia. What? Okay.
سؤال للسيد كريس ليا، ألا يعتقد معه أن النظام الأمريكي الذي قام في أصله على جماجم الملوك الحمر والذي باعتراف النظام الأمريكي أنه قتل أكثر من 18 مليون هندي أحمر وأقام نظامه على ذلك، ألا يعتقد أن تركيبة هذا النظام، أنا أستغني الشعب من سؤال، أتحدث عن النظام، أنه صاحب سياسة أن يبيد أي ثقافة وأي دين وأي فكر لا يتماشى مع هواه ولا يختار؟
The question to you, Chris, is that do you see that the American administration and its knowing its history, and I'm talking not about the American people, but the administrations that have come along throughout history, after the genocide of the American Native Indians, 18 million of them across the Americas, after seeing this, do you believe that the United States as an entity has been against anything that stands in its way?
I'm not necessarily the biggest history buff, but I almost forgot that I had a translator. I was going to remind you. I didn't want to give the wrong impression. I don't speak Arabic, but I mean, what country doesn't? You know, like I don't mean to stand up here and. Rant rave about like anti-American sentiment. I love the country I come from. And what country doesn't have blood on its hands now? You know, we've all every country, every culture, every society has to some degree perpetrated massive human rights violations across the board. We killed a lot of I have never killed a Native American, by the way. We've done some horrible things in the past, and we've been excessively forceful with a lot of cultures, and we're being excessively forceful again. I guess the answer to your question is yes. America does tend to roll over like a tank over any obstacles that stand in its way towards more power and more money, like any world power ever always has. It's just, I believe that's the nature of a world power.
Thank you.
I'll just make a comment, and I will quote one of my colleagues who was in Guantanamo, my cellmate, Feroz Abbasi, who's not here. I don't think he's here. But I remember he had a combatant status review tribunal. And in this combatant status review tribunal, they determine whether you are an enemy of the United States or not. And Feroz, in his passion, decided to quote to the judge, Malcolm X. He said, "I'm not anti-American. I don't hate America. I don't condemn America. But if America is guilty, then she stands condemned." And I think that that's the important part about this. It's not about being anti-American or anti-anything else, but there is a tendency we can see quite clearly. In the prisons of Bagram, you can see on every cell, at least at the time when I was there, there was a description of every cell. Each cell had a title. One was called the USS Cole after the bombing of it in the Gulf of Aden. Okay, you can understand it's to do with allegedly Al-Qaeda. Then there was the Twin Towers. Okay, you can understand the mentality. But then others really gave the game away, at least as far as the mentality was concerned. One was called Somalia after the Black Hawk Down fiasco. Another was called Libya, Colonel Gaddafi. And another was called Beirut, which was to do with the bombing of the barracks in 1982 by the Shiite Hezbollah. Common denominator? I didn't see any names that alluded to other American affairs like Vietnam, or Panama, or Grenada, or Korea. That was the common denominator. And that was one of the things that we saw that as Muslims, that this seems clearly directed towards a policy that at this point is towards Muslims.
Thank you. Please.
Hi. Is it me? Sorry. My name is Carol Vinson. I'm part of the National Stop the War campaign, as well as being a mother. And in the last few weeks, it's been quite painful to watch what's been going on in Islam. But I'd like to make just a couple of comments, and then I have a question for Chris. Firstly, Omar, it's really good to see you, actually, because I'm one of those anonymous people who has been campaigning for your release. And I think we do need to support Ali and try and continue this. You know, just because people are coming home, I think we don't need to think, oh, well, that's okay, we can deal with it. They're not dealing with it. We each need to deal with it and be responsible for trying to get people home and back to their families and stop all this and shut down Guantanamo and all these little places and stop the fight for religion and so on. Also, I'd like to say I'm probably trailer trash too, Chris, and I'm proud of it. And I would be proud to have you as my son too, as a mother, because I think, like lots of young people who are making the decision to join the British forces or forces all over the world and going out into these countries, you know, mistakes are made and sometimes you don't realise until it's a bit late. What you've done actually is very brave in actually contacting Mosem. The strength of the character of Mosem is that he's made his contact and you're able to do this and be part of this. My question to you, Chris, is you said it had changed your life. I'd like to know what impelled you to contact Mosem and what was the biggest difference in your life being in this 65 experience?
I didn't contact Mosem. Mosem contacted me. After Winter Soldier, the Winter Soldier testimonials were held by the Iraq Veterans Against the War, which is an organization I'm probably a member of, and they were distributed throughout Al Jazeera, and I believe BBC covered it. I don't know exactly what route you found the Winter Soldier testimonial.
Alternate.
Yeah, but it's. So Mosem found me through that, and I found that's largely what's given me that organization is what has allowed me to do everything I've done, which has given me the strength to do everything I've done and the legal support, because this is I'm not in anything less than a totally confusing legal predicament right now. Yeah, that having found that organization, and I was really just looking for veterans to talk to, because I couldn't communicate with anybody. I was extremely isolated after I got back home. I had some friends, but I don't know. I I was just, depressed and doing a lot of drugs and not really doing anything with my life and trying to figure things out, constantly confused and screwing up all of my relationships. So I tried to reach out to a group of veterans to find out at least if there was, other people out there, other veterans who I could at least talk about the military experience with, because I couldn't get it off my mind. And luckily I ran into a bunch of radical punks that got trapped in the machine, and they've been totally awesome. So that's how I've come to be here.
Thank you. More hands?
Yeah.
Please. There's one over here. Oh, sorry, Islam Channel. Can we just take Islam Channel first? And then... Well, of course, the media has a tremendously important role. It also has huge constraints. And as you mentioned, Gaza, I think it's sort of obvious, but it's striking the fact that if you look at Al Jazeera, you can see in an hour, you can see four or five correspondents reporting from Gaza on what is happening in Gaza. If you read the Western press, you will hear that, quote, no journalists are allowed in Gaza. And I think this is completely scandalous and actually quite inexplicable. I can't understand why they're being so poor on that. But on the question of Guantanamo, the media is a kind of fickle friend. It has a very short attention span, and 7 years is just a bit too much for them. And it's therefore very difficult to get the kind of article that Mirzem wrote in The Independent was, as far as I know, the only one that was written over that period. And it wasn't interesting. It wasn't written by a journalist. It was written by him. But I think that organizations like Islam Channel, obviously you have more freedom and more possibilities of doing things in a less conventional way than the Western press does. But the one good thing about the Western press, and never underestimate it, is the letters page. You can write letters to the papers on issues like this. And I'm surprised that there aren't actually more letters. And maybe that's something else that can come out of this meeting, that people can write letters about Shaka and write letters about the fact, as Mirzem said, it is completely scandalous that they're still treated as enemy combatants. And it's not only Mirzem and others that have no passports. The British residents who came back have never had their residency rights properly restored to them, despite tremendous efforts by their lawyers and various other people. The tag of enemy combatant is still hanging about there. And I think it's kind of our duty as civil society to try to do the work that the media on the whole is not doing. Enough from me.
Can I just say on the point of letters, a lot of people feel that, on the point of letters, a lot of people feel, I don't know what to write, how to write it, etc. And what a lot of people perhaps aren't aware of is that on a lot of internet sites, there are template letters, and if we could get some more specific template letters, for example, about
Very good point. Keep your eye on the website of Cage Prisoners and also of CAMPAC. That's CAMPAC. And if you just put it into Google, you'll find a tremendous amount of information and mobilizations of various sorts. And any help that you want in writing letters, either of those organizations will produce people who will help you at once. Now, over here, very patiently, has been somebody waiting for the microphone.
Salam.
Salam.
My question, inshallah, is to Sheikh Jalaluddin. Can you please tell us how and in what circumstances your brother was taken by the Americans, number one, and number two, what is your government, the Qatari government, doing about it?
Yeah, sorry, I didn't hear your question, first questions, and the accent, sorry about that. And actually, my brothers, they kept me in the United States in Illinois the same day they kept me. I mean, like after 4 hours, and December 12th. No, they kept me December 6th, but when the CIA meets me in December 12th, the same day. So, and this is the reason. This is why I know the reason. And about your question about my government, they do what they can do, but we need all of us from our government to make more pressure. But there is vertical stuff. We didn't know about it. Thanks.
There's one over there. I'm sorry, you just have to wait your turn. There are a lot of hands up. Go ahead.
It's a question for Chris. You said earlier that you're proud of your country. Sorry, you're proud of America. I was just wondering which parts of America are you proud of?
I must be hallucinating. I don't think I said I was. I'm not sure I remember saying I'm proud of America, and if I did, I slipped. I am a disappointed resident of America right now. I'm proud of America's, for instance, its literature. I don't know, it's driven a good deal of my life. Half of everything I do right now was inspired by the novels of Jack Kerouac, who was born and raised American. I'm inspired by, I'm proud of a lot of the culture, but the culture comes out of the people of America. I'm proud of the ethics coming from the working class. I'm proud of my family inside of America. I'm proud of the working. I'm just proud of the working class, the labor we've done there. I'm proud that we invented the assembly line. I'm proud that we perfected the manufacturing of cars. I'm proud that inside of America, we have, I believe, mastered the form of rock and roll well beyond the British. I'm proud of a good deal of the cultural benefits of being an American, but I think that we're run by a bunch of total jerks who are obsessed with money and power, and I'm not at all proud of them, and I'm not proud of us not standing up to them. I'm not proud of how little we know culturally about everybody else we're influencing, especially the people we're killing. I'm not proud of necessarily the level of education we get about other places. It's complicated, but there are definitely parts that I am proud of.
Thank you.
Prisoners do to raise awareness like this in the States?
I wouldn't say that it necessarily changed my opinion about Islam or the Muslim, the Muslim world, or is you know Muslim people, because I didn't have any information before. It became my opinion. You know, like it grew through meeting people, I mean, when I came back home to a place that still hadn't received that culture, or received that information about Islamic culture, I can't say that I really had all that much to bring back about it with me. Recently, my family, like my mom specifically, by proxy through the work that I do, has gotten a great deal of information about Islam. I'm still like super in the learning phase here on a lot of like history and culture and everything about it. So we're kind of all raising our awareness together. But I think I've positively impacted at least my family and my friends. Now I do my part to stop intolerance where I see it, and you know I've become much less spineless about approaching people who say ridiculously uninformed, bigoted things just out of the blue because they're just because they're talking just to talk, and yeah.
Thank you. The lady in green.
I don't know quite what I would tell them. You know, it's kind of an individual matter on how one goes about getting through that. But I would remind them that, first message, the paper that we signed that they will sign when they leave Guantanamo Bay that says that we're not allowed to talk to the media is apparently null and void. So don't worry about that. Oh, I'm definitely encourage them to talk to the media. I'd encourage them to talk to everybody. I'd encourage them to talk to the person working at the counter at the grocery store about Guantanamo. Why not?
Thank you.
I'm going to be in jail.
This lady, yes.
Hi. My name is Corey Kreider. I'm an attorney with Reprieve, an organization here that represents around 30 of the prisoners in Guantanamo. There are a couple of things I just wanted to say briefly. First, about Gerardo's brother, Ali. He keeps forgetting to tell all of you how Ali was picked up. He was taken from his home in Peoria, Illinois, away from his family, and taken to the Brigham in Charleston, where he is still. In terms of what's going to happen going forward, I won't bore you too much with legal details, but Ali's case is actually about to come up before the Supreme Court this term. So what that means practically is that the Obama administration, if they don't send Ali home forthwith, is going to have to defend in the very, very first months of its administration the detention of a quote-unquote enemy combatant in the United States. This is a key moment for all of us to put political pressure on the U.S. to release him. I don't think that the Obama administration should have great investment in defending the mistakes of the prior administration on something so patently outrageous. So we do have a good moment in the first couple of months of this year to do something really positive for Ali. The other thing I would say as we're looking going forward is that with a lot of our clients, we're in the ironic position right now of having to fight to keep them in Guantanamo Bay. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but it's because they come from places like Tunisia, which I believe the British call Tunisia, Algeria, Uzbekistan, other places where just by being stamped, like Mozambique, stamped an enemy combatant, they are guaranteed, have been threatened, or are absolutely certain to be abused, very likely tortured. And I've spoken to many of my clients and they said, Guantanamo's bad, I want to be free, but until you can find me somewhere else, please just keep me here. Better the devil we know than the fate we don't, or rather the fate perhaps that we do. European countries so far have not extended their hands to take refugees from Guantanamo. This is about 50 people we're talking about. European countries, as we all know, shared some responsibility for participation in Guantanamo. The airplanes passed over European jurisdiction. Sometimes they stopped and refueled. All of the gentlemen here, the brothers, could tell you that many European countries were perfectly happy to send teams of interrogators to question people at Guantanamo in the most abusive, earliest years. But when it's come to taking, what we're really just talking about a few dozen refugees and giving them a safe home, because that system has made it impossible for them to go home to their families, they've closed their doors so far.
I have a question for you on that, Henry, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Well, if we're trying to send these few remaining people back home, so we're acknowledging and we're looking for another place, do they have to keep being shackled in 3-piece suits and remaining in cells, or could we maybe lighten the burden of this whole, detentions game? If we're ready to say that, you know, we're looking for a place to send them where they can be free, shouldn't we lay off
the whole thing.
Yeah. Can I just interject here for a second? It's just, Chris, as I told you before, it's completely logical. They actually think we may escape on our way to freedom.
It's a long swim. Absolutely. I mean, besides ameliorating their conditions, let speak to their families and that sort of thing, the United States needs to be working a lot harder to find somewhere safe for them to go. We've heard some noises. We're talking about what everyone can do. We've started to hear some noises from European countries that, with the new administration, they might actually accept these refugees. As I said, we're talking about 50 people. One of the things you can do is you can write to the British government and say the British government needs to do its part, not just in taking Shakir Anwar, Binyam Mohammed, Ahmed El-Basha, and the other British residents back, but in helping solve the refugee crisis in general and making sure that for those 50 people, closing Guantanamo is not a tragedy that sends them to somewhere even worse than where they are now.
Just to correct one thing you said, Corey, actually there is one nation in Europe, that great bastion of democracy and freedom and justice, Albania, that has received 5 Guantanamo detainees.
That's true. That is the lone European country to take anyone there. I think maybe 5 to 7 people who, I have to say, have not said the most positive things about their time in Albania since they've gotten out. But let's hope that a few other people step up.
Thank you. Zachary, could I just ask if you've got anything to add? Can you just pass the mic one further? On this issue of trying to find safe places and also the kind of places that your clients would prefer to go to.
I'm Zachary Katznelson, I'm the legal director of Reprieve, and I also represent prisoners in Guantanamo. I've been there many times myself to visit with the prisoners there, hear their stories. I think there are a large number of men, of these 50 people, who lived in Europe. They were legal residents either in Britain, in Italy, France, a variety of places, but they seek somewhere safe, somewhere where they can rebuild their lives. I think one of the critical issues for everybody who's here, who's been in Guantanamo, and for everyone who will get out, is assistance that they need to get back on their feet, that to deal with 6-7 years of abuse and isolation is no easy thing. And as Geraldo was saying, to be in isolation and suddenly be thrust out into the world, it's a scary idea. And so we all need to step forward to help those men reintegrate, readjust, give them the support when they need. Somewhere like Qatar, where Jarala is from, is actually a quite probable destination for some men. If we can achieve a solution for Ali Omari, I believe we can achieve a solution for a number of other men as sort of a package deal. Qatar is willing to accept prisoners. European countries like Portugal, have said they are willing to accept prisoners if Europe as a whole agrees. The time is now to press, for all of us to press as much as possible. A solution is within our grasp, but the hands has to close, and it only will if we all push. So hopefully everyone can take a simple step, just a few minutes, write a letter, make a call, speak to your friends. Don't let this time pass by. Now is the time, absolutely now, to take this forward. 9 days, Obama will be in office. Don't let this opportunity go. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr.
Just to add, there are people in this country who regard the Guantanamo detainees as still threats and so forth. If you've been to Guantanamo, there's a stigma attached with you that you are a terrorist. America couldn't have got it wrong. But there's one thing I think is really important. People in Guantanamo have been through hundreds, in fact, thousands of interrogations. There is nobody that is more vetted than the Guantanamo detainees. You couldn't have that sort of system for any asylum seekers here. So if you want to get people here, that's another way to argue the case, to say that these people have been vetted by the CIA, by the MI5, by military intelligence, by every alphabet agency that exists in the USA.
Okay, I know there are a few more hands. I think we'll take maybe about three more questions. I was told to wrap it up by 8:45. So if we could just take these two over here for a start, and then that third one over there. Have you got the mic?
Hi, my name is Nick Lozari. I'm actually a psychologist, studies of trauma and war. And in all fairness, I would like to say to all the detainees here and all the guards, I wish you the best of luck to try to get through all the trauma that I'm sure you've all suffered. How many years, I don't know, but I'm sure it's going to rest with you for the rest of your lives. I hope that one day you'll go over and say, these people didn't do me any harm. My questions are two primarily, right, for Chris. The first one was, did the U.S. military give you any special, and I'm emphasis on the special, sort of information as you were going, as you were mobilizing towards the whole thing? Did they tell you, Muslims aren't necessarily people, or these are all terrorists, or whatnot? Did they give you some sort of training? And secondly, did the U.S. do you believe in the general public, and if you get it, you can speak as freely as you have to here today to us about this issue and about the future of
Yes, the military trained us extensively really rigorously for the period of about 5 hours before we left for Guantanamo Bay and cultural matters. I'm willing to consider myself an expert after what they taught me before we left for Cuba. First was that every Muslim is a terrorist, and second is that they perform some hygiene duties with their hands, so not to touch them. That's about it. Oh, and assalamu alaikum. We learned that. And we're free to speak in America. It's just irrelevant. It's just you're free to say everything you want to people that don't care. So. Certainly no real depression in the way of free speech. I mean, you can free speech it up in America as much as you please.
Thank you. Yeah. Move the youngest detainees that I ever came across were in Bagram. The youngest one I ever saw was 11 years old. The youngest detainee, I believe, that is still in Guantanamo is Mohammed Al-Gharani.
Oh.
Yeah,
Mohammed
Al-Gharani,
who's from Chad. And of course, one of the most famous or detainees or well-known cases is that of Omar Khadr, who is the only Westerner still held in Guantanamo. I was present when they first brought him into custody. He had lost his eye. His chest had been shot out from the left, and there were huge exit wounds that would clearly make him look like he was almost dead. I don't know how he survived this, but he was one of the youngest people that I saw. And there were others who at the age of 13 and 14 were also brought in. These children are no longer children. After 7 years, they've grown into young adult males. And there was a place in Guantanamo called Camp Iguana where these young children were held. And of course, Camp Iguana is now no longer used for children because they're no longer children. As far as the legal process is concerned, I think there have been attempts to get people like Donald Rumsfeld for being involved in and ordering and suggesting methods of torture, which have included being made to stand for hours on end, and the very real policy that he had and terminology that he used that dropped like a penny right down to the average soldier who interpreted it through what they call the standard operating procedure, that striking a detainee with a peroneal strike in the leg a few hundred times is something that you can do to subdue the detainee. And in one case, that led to a death. So these sorts of things have precedent. They have precedent in Europe in relation to war crimes trials and so forth. I don't know whether that's going to happen now, but future generations may do so.
I think we'll end it there. And thank you very much, everybody who contributed. And thank you in particular to our panel, to Chris, to Mirzam, Jarila, and Omar for speaking. Thank you all for coming.